Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. It's chilly here on the East Coast. I'm in Florida and I'm not complaining about, you know, the cold really, but native Floridians are having a meltdown. It was like 40 degrees last night and the native Floridians were having like an abject meltdown. I walked into the grocery store last night in a hoodie and flip-flops and a pair of shorts. And I was the if looks could kill, I would have been dead. But it is cold here on the East Coast and in the Midwest.
Did security follow you around?
Well, they would follow me around anyway. It doesn't really matter. So, you know, you're incorrigible once you're no longer needed anymore. So, but you know, we're here. And Wade is hardy as an upper Midwestern guy, even though it's probably negative 40 in Wisconsin. He's only wearing a flannel. It may not even be a legit flannel lined. And Matt in the nick of the north out there at 5 a.m. walking the dogs. I get it.
Yes.
Yeah, I get it. So we're here. We're gonna have a great conversation. As always, here with Matt Kachansky, retired special agent in charge from HHS-OIG, then second iteration of Matt, the Northeast UPIC director, and now the director of our program integrity team over here at Advise, and Wade McFall, who's had substantially fewer jobs than you, Matt, assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and now here at Advise. And I think Wade came right after me. So he's been here. I've been here now 6 years. Wade's been here probably close to 5 years. Yeah. Started off as a consultant with us, got a great trip to Hawaii. I'll never forget that. With someone who used to work here as well. We would have known that at the time you'd be out with the rollerblader. So yeah, great stuff. So today we want to go back and talk about a few things that we talk about this topic a lot. We talk about provider abrasion. We want to talk about it from a little bit of a different perspective. We want to kind of talk about quickly the flow of provider abrasion that can come out from two things. One is on the record request piece of it, where you're annoying providers by asking for records. And then the second part is when providers want to get on the phone with the SIU team and talk about overpayment letters that they may have gotten. So Wade, you know, one of the things that, you know, at the OIG, we never really heard the word, the phrase provider abrasion was an entirely foreign concept to us, right? Yeah. For us, you know, if you stole a dollar, we wanted two. If you were a criminal, we wanted you in handcuffs. And I'm making light of this, but, you know, provider abrasion for us was, are the handcuffs too tight or not, right? Because we didn't really have this functional conversation about, you know, when we send a subpoena to a provider and we ask for 100 records or we do a search warrant or whatever, how that's going to affect the provider, if they're going to be angry or upset. I don't think it really is a factor. But in the payer world, which is the world that we're currently operating in and a lot of the work that we're doing with our SIU partners, provider abrasion can be a real thing, right? You don't want a provider who, for example, is a very large provider of services to that plan's beneficiary population, their member population, you know, and they threaten to pull out of the contract or things. There's kind of that, you know, you got to find that fine line. But let's just talk from the investigative perspective. The biggest thing I think that creates the initial abrasion are the record requests. Is it going to be for a statistically valid random sample where the minimum data set is typically 100 if we're following the CMS program integrity manual, which we do here, which we encourage the payer community to do as well, why reinvent the wheel? And if you're not going to do a statistically valid random sample, the CMS Program Integrity Manual, Chapter 8, which talks about statistical sampling, overpayment estimations, also talks about probe sampling, and talks about probe samples of 20 to 40. We like to talk about a sample of 30 for consistency. So you're going to get maybe a smaller provider abrasion. But you know, the issue has to always do with how do you help to reduce that provider abrasion by asking for a smaller number of records? But also, how do you not necessarily let the provider know that they're, you know, the investigation, you know, once they get that letter, they're going to know that there's an audit or investigation. But, you know, some of the maybe the hints, tips and tricks about being able to continue to conduct your investigation in a slightly covert manner, but obviously in that same vein, get what you need to do without having an inordinate amount of abrasion on that provider.
Yeah, well, I think you hit on the key point is the difference between a statistically valid random sample and a probe sample. You know, like you said, they oftentimes don't like to get, you know, a request for 100 or so records because it is a way on their, you know, staff and stuff. Someone's got to pull those records and scan them and email them or whatever. And then the other side of that too is if we are going to extrapolate, those overpayments can be substantially more than if we were doing just a probe sample and we had, like you said, maybe 30 or 40 claims, depending on what the claims pay. But typically an overpayment for a probe sample would be much lower than extrapolated. Of course, that depends on the review itself. Maybe the review goes sure. through and 95% of them are paid, but if it's a typical, half of them are going to be not supported, the overpayment's going to be much higher if it's extrapolated. The other thing that you mentioned though is also if you want to kind of keep your, not show your hand on what everything you're looking for, if it's a probe sample, you can request whatever you want. You can go in and say, okay, I'm only going to take 40, request 40 records. You might as well take 40 records that are going to be the higher paying of kind of the universe that they bill. So if it's a probe sample, order or request whatever you want. If it's a SBRS, you have to keep the integrity of that universe, but that doesn't mean in the medical record request you can't throw in something to the request to kind of throw them off. If you're looking at all 99214s or something like that, you can throw in some other requests that will kind of not show your hand on everything you're looking at. But then when you get those records back, you basically pull those out and don't include them in the review of the valid sample. So that can kind of hide what you're looking for, in a sense, if that's the intention.
Right. Yeah, and I think, part of it is when you're doing a probe sample, you want to stay away to an extent, if you can, from cherry picking the sample that you're asking for, whether it be 20, 30, 40. You may have to cherry pick for some particular reason. For example, if you've got beneficiary complaints that have come in, you certainly want to get those records. The question is, do you include them as part of your sample, if it's a probe sample or not? If you're doing a statistically valid random sample and it's, let's say it's 100 or 105 records and records that you really want to look at from beneficiary complaints or whatever are not in that sample, you can always request them. Providers don't know that it's a statistically valid random sample. They just know they have a request for records. And they have to produce those, those records. And in that same vein, I don't want to beat this horse dead, but the use of attestations is always going to be an important piece of that, that you need to be able to make sure that when a provider sends you their records, they're going to sign an attestation. That attestation is just what's written on the piece of paper. But certainly, if a provider is looking to appeal things, you at least have a document that you could produce as part of an appeal or an administrative law judge or a district judge hearing, where the provider is acknowledging, I gave you everything that you asked me for, including but not limited to, kind of that, where we talked about that over the past couple of weeks, to help to at least bolster that when that happens. But that's the first part of provider abrasion, is the provider gets the letter. And in today's climate, providers and payers, it's an acrimonious relationship. The provider community doesn't like the payer community. The payer community, I think, unfortunately, they need the provider community. So, but I think it's a lot more acrimonious when letters are coming from the payer to the provider about records. And there's always the defensive mechanism of, I've done nothing wrong, so why do you want this? But ultimately, it's a contractual obligation. And in the CMS space, it's a legal regulatory obligation, because when you sign that CMS 855 form to become a Medicare participating provider, you're basically agreeing to being audited and investigated and all of that. But then, what happens on not uncommonly is the provider gets the review gets done. There's an overpayment, and the overpayment letter goes out from the plan saying, we've done this review. Here are our findings. Here's what you owe. Cash, check, or charge. Please let us know. And then the conversations ensue. And so, Matt, it's not uncommon, and you know this, it is not uncommon for providers to want to have a conversation. What I have always said to the providers when they want to have these conversations, this is not the time for roadside court. Meaning, when you get pulled over by a police officer and they're writing you a ticket, trying to sit and argue why you shouldn't get the ticket is not, that's not the place. You're getting the ticket. Similarly, when you are setting up a meeting from the SIU perspective to speak with a provider who is not happy about the fact that they have an overpayment, that you're not trying, the argument has to be, we're talking high level, we're having these conversations, but if you wish to argue that a particular claim should not have been paid, this is not the time. There's an appropriate thing. But the one thing that we are learning, and I recently participated in some of these calls with one of our SIU clients, was that there really is a gap in education and training from the SIU investigator to be able to control the narrative of the meeting. The meeting is not for the purpose of a provider looking to have a line-by-line discussion. So let's talk about that, Matt. Let's talk about some of those hints, tips, and tricks on how to control the, you know, we're not talking about controlling the narrative. That's a bad way to put it, but it's how are you controlling the conversation? Because it's your conversation to control.
Right. And just it doesn't start with the conversation. Just like an interview, the most important part of an interview is prepping for it. Similarly, it's the conversations that you have with the provider. It goes back to how are you requesting the records? And you know, you talked about the difference between SVRS and a random sample. Yeah. The decisions have to be made up front based on what the data shows, what the program integrity history of that provider is. Which way you're going to go? Is this should this be a probe sample because it's a first-time offender on a smallish issue? So that lessens your provider abrasion there by you know strategizing and tailoring the investigative steps to what the facts of the case are, to include what is the history of this provider? Have they ever been educated before? Things like that. So that kind of lessens the abrasion there because it's in line with what this provider's been doing. But once that's done, medical review is done. The provider wants to have a conversation. Again, you have to prep. You know, don't just, you know, set a time and then have them call because then it's a free for all. You should talk to the provider or send them an email about, okay, we're going to have this call. It's going to be for a set amount of time, 30 minutes, to maximize the effectiveness of that time. Please send me your questions or issues ahead of time so we I can I can prepare. I can work with the coder or the nurse that did the review to get references, to get whatever answers might be applicable. We're not going to go line by line. We will talk about general issues. There was probably four or five different reasons why all of the claims were denied, or some of them, a mixture of them. We can talk about those issues and how these policies apply to that. But in terms of what line by line, no. The other thing you can do is, and again, this is the mindset of the investigator. If this is an overpayment issue, you're not talking to the Lindbergh kidnapper. It doesn't have to be adversarial. If the goal is to resolve it in a as congenial, it's never going to be friendly, but it can be congenial if you both have the same goal to get to the bottom line and get the case finished.
Right.
So if you have that in mind, set that agenda, and then once he sends the questions or the agenda items, you prepare for those things. You have them in advance, and then you go line by line through those agenda items. Here's what I have. Here's this. Here's that. And you control the agenda. If you start to ask it, but on this one, this particular one, it's like if you have a particular question on a particular claim, the letter points out how you can appeal it. You know, send
Right.
in additional documentation. We'll look at it again. And
Right.
again, you have to show them that you don't believe that they're, you know, a war criminal. But you do believe that they did something wrong, whether by mistake or happenstance or whatever, and those things have to be resolved, educated, and make them a better provider for the plan. And if that's understood and you give education as, you know, along with not the penalty, but the recoupment,
Right.
they appreciate that. And the last thing is, and this is what Carrie Mead talks about all the time, be prepared to negotiate. If it's an upcoding issue and you have the ability or the authority, you know, and you've hit them with an overpayment letter that was a full denial, talk to them about, we understand that you did provide a service. We're not saying you didn't provide a service. And here's the credit we will give you for, you know, the level of service that was documented in the file.
Right.
And
Yeah, there's.
that really tones it down.
Right. And that is, you know, that is the challenge. So, you know, kind of the wrap up to this is, first of all, Wade, when we're looking at records, one of the things we always have to consider is if we're doing work, for example, in the Medicaid space, does the single state payer or the policymaker allow for statistical sampling? Like we know We have a contract that we're doing where when we started the contract several years ago, the Medicaid department in that state, the director allowed statistical sampling and overpayment estimation. And then a couple of years in, changed their minds and said, no, the rule changed. There's no more statistical sampling allowed. You have to do only actual. We know that in some other states, they've put kind of moratoriums on that and then recalibrated and then said, okay, you guys can go back and do statistical sampling. So you have to know what your guidelines are in that state about whether you can do that sampling. And Matt, I think, you know, the biggest thing and the example I'm going to give is that investigators have to be in a position that, you know, the phone calls, the teams with the video, whatever it may be, those meetings with the providers have to have a solid end time. You know, we're going to spend 30 minutes speaking to you. And at the end of 30 minutes, we have to disconnect this call, whether we're finished or not, because what we don't need is to be in a position where the provider is controlling the narrative of the conversation. This is, you know, these calls, these meetings are courtesy meetings. They're not intended to be a line by line recitation of arguing why you think the EKG should have been paid when we think it should have been denied. There is a protocol through whether it's a dispute resolution, an appellate process, whatever it is, providers get letters that explain how to appeal their denials and make that pitch the formal way. But sitting on a phone call to go line by line is not really what it's about. If a provider disagrees with a claim that's been denied, that's what the appeals process is for. The SIU should not be getting engaged in these individual anecdotal discussions line by line. And I use this as an example because last week I was on one of these calls where the provider wanted to literally go through every denial line. It was a 1,000-line spreadsheet. And I said to the doctor, how do you perceive we're going to achieve this review of this in 30 minutes? We're not doing a line by line. You need to understand that's not what this is for. If you want to understand how we came to these conclusions, we can point you to the references that we used and all of that, but we're not having these kind of conversations. As an SIU team, your staff needs to be conversant in being able to control the conversation, not the narrative, because the provider's narrative is their narrative. But, you know, so as we wrap up, Matt, I want to give you kind of the final word. What are some of the, you know, where do you think some of those pain points? You already talked about coming up with your list of questions, right? What's another piece of the puzzle? Let's just give one or two things that you think, you know, where SIU investigators are going to be able, like, to control the conversation.
Yeah, it's going to be you as an investigator need to know the policies. You need to know why those claims were denied and have the things in hand to share with the provider. This is why we did it. I know it was referenced in the spreadsheet or whatever you had. Here's the actual policy. Here's the reference. Take it. If you don't agree with it, that's something you can appeal, and just keep putting them off to the appellate process to actually, you know, take an action against the determinations and use this discussion as just that. If there is general conceptual misunderstandings or lack of information on the provider's part as to why, you can explain those things. And I can give an example of that very quickly. Is we had a case on a therapy place, and what we found is that they were billing for inordinately long therapy sessions with multiple therapists, you know, speech therapy, occupational speech, you know, physical therapy, all in one day, taking 3 or 4 hours. As it turns out, what they talked about in this conversation was those therapies are going on, and what we found in the medical records is the, you know, the therapies were lasting about an hour. And they said, yeah, those, it lasted an hour, but two of the therapists, if it was two, were both with the patient the entire time doing their different therapies. So 2 hours of work were being done in 1 hour. You know, so that was something we could take into account, and they could then appeal to that. So we agreed that that was an issue that they should appeal. So, but it's, right. You know, it's using that type of discussion to talk about those type of things rather than, I don't care what you say, this x-ray should be counted because right. It was needed. That's right. that doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, and that's a good point, right? These line by line reviews, or for the provider to complain about whatever. You know, the example I'll give is the call that I was on last week. The provider spent the first 5 or 7 minutes of the conversation telling me about how well respected that he and his practice was in the community. And so, you know, I acknowledge it. Okay, doctor, I appreciate that you're very well respected in the community. He's a Medicaid provider. He's probably the only one in his area. All of that is important. I respect that. I appreciate you sharing that that is something, but that doesn't negate the fact that you billed for something that wasn't documented in your chart. And you have to just level set that. Like, you know, appreciate it. I think part of that is, as an SIU investigator, is having the wherewithal to be able to have that active listening and that interactive piece, but also be in a position as the investigator to know your facts, know your things, know your people, places, and things, and be able to control the conversation. I mean, we spend a lot of time doing that training to our SIU clients as part of process improvement is interviewing and documentation. This is really no different.
Absolutely.
This is just an offshoot of doing that. And we're probably going to be and we're going to be bringing that in to, you know, we have a client that we're going to be doing some training on, and we're going to be talking about documentation and interviewing. And this is going to be part of that conversation because I think people tend to inherently think of interviewing and the conversation of an interview with members or beneficiaries and a lot less with the provider. And more importantly, is often that adversary, the inherent adversarial nature. You know, on this particular instance, we were trying to end the call early, and the doctor said, "You told me you have me until the bottom of the hour. My clock says I have 5 minutes left to talk to you." To an extent, you know, he's not wrong. The call was going nowhere, but to an extent, it's like we told him we'd give him 30 minutes. And, you know, how do you shape the last few minutes of that? So it's, you know, it's an ongoing process. And, you know, I think it's an interesting conversation, but it's something that, you know, Wade, your piece, Matt, your piece, they really do tie in together because that
Yes.
abrasion does work. And it's two totally different types of abrasion. Providers pissed off and mad about the fact that the payer is asking for records. And then later on, the provider pissed off and mad about the fact that the result is that you now owe us money. And they're pissed off for two reasons. Pissed off about having to give you records, and then pissed off about the fact that you've challenged them on their omnipotence of being healthcare providers, right? So,
Yeah, and
you
how they
know.
respond to the first probably shapes how the conversation is going to go on in the second. Because if they were cooperative and all that, that goes into the building of the relationship with the provider to have those type of adversarial conversations without getting it out of control.
Right. We're all just trying to get this resolved and move on to the next thing. And we're hoping that as a provider that, you know, you can get some education and training so that you don't have this happen again, right? That the error is not there and that you're not having this problem. So yeah, it's a very complicated issue. I think, you know, we're going to continue doing it. I'm excited about the training that we're giving to some of our SIU clients this year on this topic, because it is the one area I think that people tend to have a lot of trepidations about. We've done LinkedIn Lives, right? Carrie Mead, one of the managers on our SIU team, has talked a lot about the art of the negotiation for resolving these matters. And you have to get good at it. And you only get good at it by having people around you that are already good at doing it and kind of following that lead, to become conversant in how to have that, you know, that conversation. So we'll continue having it. And these anecdotal stories will continue to pop up. So as always, great to see you guys. We're all staying warm. To anybody that's out there on the West Coast, stay vigilant. It's terrible times that are going on, and hopefully that recovery can start and these fires will come to an end. And for those of you in areas that have never seen snow before, you know, and you don't have a shovel, I will tell you, don't throw warm water on your car, please. Heed, stay off the roads, do the things that you're supposed to do. And for those that live in communities where they don't even own a shovel or a plow, that's what cardboard boxes are for, and magazines and circulars and things of that like. You can scoop away the snow that you need to. And if anybody was thinking of why they didn't need auto start in the winter, this is the reason why you need auto start for your car.
Remote start is a wonderful thing.
Wonderful thing. So as always, we appreciate everybody tuning into our weekly OIG Roundtable podcast. We got some great content coming up in the next few weeks. I think next week is my LinkedIn Live with the incomparable Gene Stone, where we're going to be talking about the senior Medicare patrol and a follow-up from previous conversations and why the senior Medicare patrol is so important. We have a whole bunch of those coming up in the next few months. We've got tons of content. Again, you can always get our newsletter to your inbox. AdviseHealth.com is where you want to go to get that, and get that in your inbox every Friday, the newsletter. You can also get this podcast as well on Spotify and on YouTube and the like. So until next time, we will see you all on the next OIG Roundtable. Have a good one, everyone.
Thank you.